Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, good friends. Thank you for joining us on the Bill Press Pod. Good to see you back, and welcome to this special edition, the final episode of our four-part series on the American presidency with Doug Brinkley. Now, in the first three segments of this special Bill Press Pod edition, with historian Douglas Brinkley as our guide, and gleaning what lessons we can learn from yesterday's presidents to influence our choice today, we've looked at the presidency from three perspectives. One, what qualities and character do we want in a president? Two, which presidents stand out as our best and why? Three, how important are those the president names as his team, the top people around him? Now, remember, we keep reminding you that our purpose with this presidential series is not to persuade you and me. I think you have already made up your mind. The purpose is to remind us how important this election is. What can the American presidency, the history of the American presidency, teach us about the kind of person that should hold that job, and how unthinkable it is that anybody named Donald Trump was there in the first place or should ever get back to the White House. To remind us again how critical this election is to the survival of our democracy and the protection of all the freedoms that we enjoy. So with that in mind, today with Professor Brinkley, we bring it all home and apply it to the choice we've got to make in 2024. Somehow we survived 4 years of Donald Trump. Now we've seen almost 4 years of Joe Biden. What a contrast. So let's look at Biden and Trump side by side. Apply all the lessons we've learned from presidential history with Doug Brinkley to the two of them and decide what's best for the country. It will be, without doubt, the most important vote that we will have cast in our lifetime so far. Doug Brinkley, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Here we go, concluding our series on presidential history. It's great to have you along for the ride.
I've been enjoying it.
Thank you so much. So, you know, in our earlier sessions, the last three, we focused a lot on people or some of the early presidents that in the last century, the great presidents. Wanted to take a look this time, particularly at our more modern presidents, especially a look at the current one and his predecessor, as Joe Biden calls him. But Doug, I want to start with a more fundamental question. Already this early in the 21st century, we have had two presidents, George W. and Donald Trump, who lost the popular vote and yet still ended up in the Oval Office because of the Electoral College. What's your take on the Electoral College and how democratic is it?
Well, it's unfortunate that we're married to the Electoral College. I only put a very little amount of energy into changing it simply because we just won't have the numbers anytime soon. I mean, we'd have to have two-thirds in you know, even three-quarters of the Senate agreeing to this to get it even, get it moving in that direction. It disappoints people. The young people in particular that believe we're a democracy, it should be whoever wins the most votes president. And as you point out, if that were the case, Al Gore would have been president, Hillary Clinton would have been president. Instead, we're stuck with this Electoral College. The reason it hangs in there is really for rural America, for states like South Dakota and Wyoming that, you know, they have so few, such a light population, yet they have an inordinate amount of power because they deliver Electoral College delegates and they have two U.S. senators And so it's always going to be a rub on the Democratic Party these days, because I could predict right now with almost certainty that the winner of the most votes is going to be Joe Biden this election. But I'm 50-50 on whether he can become president or not, because of the way the Electoral College map is, with winner take all. And it allows the Electoral College to create third party miscreants or troublemakers or spoilers, call them what you want. But, you know, you're starting to have Cornel West running in a state like Michigan, attracting Arab Americans. You have Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has a name, and the anti-vax people and some environmentalists backing him. You know, you have Jill Stein with the Green Party, who's always good for a point or two. And that's going to change each state's dynamics. So it's, if it were the popular vote, it wouldn't matter so much. But when it's winner take all in these states, it makes people feel that the conclusion of who is president isn't accurate.
Have you followed at all this movement? I think it's called the National Popular Vote, whereby states agree that they would give all of their electoral votes to whoever wins a popular vote in their state. And you wouldn't have to amend the Constitution. You just have to get enough states that add up to 271.
That's probably where activism in this regard, the restructuring, is going to occur, because it's just too hard to get a constitutional amendment done. So it seems to me that if you're engaged in politics now, you have to play with the map you're dealt with and the rules you're handed, and not always be living in the how unfair it is and thinking about an imaginary future. Some people can do both, but if you're going to choose one, get organized now. It's a big election, Biden, Trump, and organize people to go vote. Hold rallies, hold fundraisers, get your shoulder to the wheel in this year's election, and just don't become carping mode that it doesn't matter because of it's not even real democracy because the popular vote doesn't matter. I mean, imagine if the Florida recount of 2000 with dangling chads.
Right. Yeah.
Imagine if that's done on a national scale, that we have to do recounts in every state. You have to truly believe in your voting apparatus, your machinery, that you're going to get an accurate popular vote. So you're not just doing recounts for a month after every election. And by doing the Electoral College, it usually can boil it down to a troubled state or two, not the entire country.
Mm-hmm. Right. In the meantime, as you say, deal with the map that we've got to deal with. So, looking at the presidency itself, in this 21st century, has the presidency changed? And if so, how?
I think it changed where you can run for president and win on criticizing the U.S. government. It used to be you would win by saying how great America was, and belief in tomorrow and can-doism. But since Reagan, the idea on the Republican side is less government is better, that what you're getting ripped off by the federal government, you're paying too much taxes, you're being told how to teach your children, the government lied to you about Vietnam and Iraq. You know, the Pentagon's buying a hammer that costs $10,000 and you're paying for it. These kind of feeling that voters are being ripped off by the federal government is a manifestation of the Reagan years onwards in the Republican Party. And it's holding sway now because that feeling, that sentiment, that cynicism met and married social media. And it created quite an offspring, because that turned into a nation filled with conspiracy theorists, and we're being flooded with misinformation. And so now it's hard to find fact from fiction, or even a photo, whether it's been shopped or cropped or done by AI or you know, there seems to be a pranksterism run amok once you get into the social media field. So it's very, very different than, say, the elections before 1980.
Right. Yeah. An irony of running to lead the government by running against the government. Figure that out, right? Does character matter anymore?
I think it does. It certainly does for me. Now, I may be old-fashioned in those regards. I guess it is. What is the definition of character? I do believe presidents are human. I can accept apologies and mistakes. So I'm not angry anymore at Bill Clinton over the Lewinsky debacle. But boy, I was ticked off in the 90s. I remember I felt betrayed by Bill Clinton because he lied, and it damaged me that the person I was for did that. At this point, Bill Clinton looks quaint compared to what's going on in Trump's White House, in money and flying in, and people selling the White House for sale and access for sale. And it's become a money scam. And in even running for politics, where you have to raise $1 billion and buy certain market time and hire the media consultants, it's become a sport for rich people. And that's unfortunate. You know, I always admired somebody like Bill Clinton because I knew was born William Blythe and grew up very poor in Arkansas, and then taught himself band instruments and educated himself to the point he could go on a scholarship to Georgetown and was a Rhodes Scholar and built his way up from nothing. And I think Clinton always understood working America or people that were struggling in a tangible way, more so than any presidents since him. And look at Clinton. He's a great two-term president. He balanced the budget. We had a surplus. We were out of major wars. We expanded NATO. Yet he's not ranked very high as a president because that his immoral behavior or his predilection for extramarital affairs and women has caused a real blight on his presidency. Otherwise, we'd be talking about him as one of the greats.
And you talked about Clinton with his one lie, and of course, the Washington Post counted up over 30,000 lies, right, in 4 years under Donald Trump. But I remember, Doug, when I was growing up, I mean, in school, right, we were taught a great respect, if not a reverence, for the president of the United States, no matter who it was. And the idea that the president never told a lie, right? That's the one thing you could count on. The president always told the truth. What happened to that?
Well, that's the way it should be. And it was the way our country was born to believe. But it really started falling apart at the time of Watergate with Woodward and Bernstein. Up until then, the press would know things, but they would not publish it. I mean, people knew John F. Kennedy was having affairs around Washington, D.C. Eisenhower told a lie about the U-2 incident, but people said that's a one-offer. He was doing it for a national security purposes. Where FDR made up things, fibbed all the time, but it seemed that the thrust of his personality of wanting to help the people most in need through the Great Depression was authentic. And as you said, we wanted our presidents to be something our kids could be. You wanted to point to your children and say, there is a great man, and maybe someday you could be like that person. And that was about telling the truth and being virtuous. But by the time of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, and a new media environment, particularly after Morley Safer did CBS reports in Vietnam showing armed Marines killing innocent South Vietnamese people, that ran on national TV. And there was some sea change around 65 where the press was adversarial And it's stayed ever since. There is now, you make your name as a reporter by and large, finding dirt on the president, finding a lie, finding something they said, giving the president a Pinocchio. Those are the ways for a reporter to get on cable TV and become a talking head and get exposure for their own brand and byline. And it used to be just in the Kennedy years, you did it by access, by being known to have tight lips, by garnering information. But if the government told you not to use it, you wouldn't. So it's really a deep dive you have to take into the executive branch's relationship with modern media.
And the public the response of the public has changed too. As opposed to being shocked by a lie, it's almost the response today is, yeah, well, they all lie, right?
Well, that's it. And once you get to they all lie, it's like when your child tells you they all do it so I can do it, it becomes a government of lies. And then you start creating what we have now, vast millions of Americans who just don't believe anything that comes out of Washington, D.C. It's almost seen as a cursed zone, the District of Columbia. And that's unfortunate because it means we haven't taught civics, geography, government to, kids in elementary school. So we've forgotten how to train people to understand the miracle of America and our constitutional democracy. Very few people know anything about basic civics or about executive and judicial and legislative branches or about, the electoral college versus popular vote. Yep. They don't understand it. Mm-mm.
Yeah, don't even teach it anymore in most cases. So we said we're going to talk about some of the modern presidents. Modern, of course, is loosely defined. This being the Bill Press Pod and my podcast, I'm going to define it as anybody from Jimmy Carter on.
You're right.
So starting 76, who up until today, if you had to pick the one or two or three that you think were maybe not the greatest presidents, but the best of that group? What would you pick?
Well, let me just say this on Jimmy Carter, since he's 99 and, we're hoping he makes it till October 1st, 2024, when he'll turn 100, be quite a milestone. Carter did a lot of things. He liked to work alone. It's a characteristic of him. Deep character and integrity. But he got things done that were important, like the Camp David Accord between Egypt and Israel with Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. The Panama Canal Treaty, which not only gave the canal and the zone back to the Panamanian people, but it established goodwill for us in our own hemisphere, particularly in South America. Mm-hmm. He's the one who recognized the People's Republic of China. He promoted human rights in our State Department. He ended up having some mistakes, I think boycotting the Moscow Olympics wasn't fair to those athletes that suddenly couldn't perform. And there was always an inner argument in the Carter years between Brzezinski, who wanted the defense budget raised in 1980 by 7%, where Vance and people wanted it raised 4 or 5%. The net result was he's a one-term president. Carter did a lot of great things. But now we look back at him less as a president and more as a
post-president,
because they used the White House for a stepping stone to greater things. And a very humble watching, and I've been able to work on a house with them, a Habitat for Humanity, and having a former president and first lady sweating all day long, working on a house harder than anybody else, putting it up. Boy, he's willing to go from the White House right to blue jeans and a hammer in a poor neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive. But as a great president, no. I think in order to be a great president, you have to turn to politics and have a kind of group of people that seem that you are a follower of them. I found that Bill Clinton I think was a very good president. Now, he caught the catbird seat in timing. I mean, he became president the year, the year after the Soviet Union broke up. So it was a time of the idea of U.S.-style democracy was flourishing around the world. And he would call it, democratic enlargement. But we were trying to bring in other countries to trade with us. And we set up trade advisors and embassies. But the long 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, minus those impeachment woes, were good days. And the 90s were days where technology was coming to the forefront in a rapid fire fashion. The people of Seattle and Microsoft and Silicon Valley and Austin with Dell, I mean, they were just having halcyon days. And it was clear America was a king of technology, and the internet was coming into a being mature enough to be the laptops and iPhones that they've become today. I happen to be very favorable to Barack Obama's 8 years. I say that because Obama, not only winning, as we've mentioned, as the first black president, but, talk about a man who didn't put a lot of sloppy sound bites out there.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
He was very controlled, figured, and knew how not to let rumor or slippage played by the rules. I think he has an incredible character. Along with Michelle and the way they raised two daughters in that kind of environment, the way that he empowered people of color, just photos of Obama touching a young black boy's hair or, being there at key moments during gun violence shootings and the like, and delivering the speeches when we needed to hear them, beating Mitt Romney for a second term. Being perhaps too ardent on the Middle East. I mean, maybe history will show his mistakes will be the drone policy towards Afghanistan, or when he gave his Nobel Prize address. It's quite a Marshall Nobel Prize address about warfare. It doesn't stand out as a peace document per se. But overall, by the time he left, I thought that you had to give him a big standing ovation for coming in there and being a very good, solid, top-notch president. But I'm afraid we has not been the time of presidential greatness from Carter on down. I mean, I find the last truly important presidents we've had were Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy. And then I'd have to say Ronald Reagan was one of those important two-term presidents. And then I put Clinton and Obama, it was with some parity, good two-termers. I think Bush 41 did well for the one term, but I think Bush 43 was a terrible president. He served two terms at a time that a president's supposed to lead us somewhere. And he bought into this neo-Wilsonian belief that it's America's job to promote democracy and build it all over the planet. And you start trying to bring countries like Iraq, filled with Shiites and Sunnis, Muslims, and Kurds. I mean, it just goes on for thousands of years over there. And now we're supposed to come rolling into town with democracy, setting up some voting booths. We came out as fools from that endeavor of Bush in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that ate up all of his clock. And then add to the fact at the end of his presidency, he gave us the Great Recession and his horrible inaction during Hurricane Katrina. I don't see how anybody can think Bush 43, nicest man as he might be, folksy and a good painter, but I don't see how people elevate him as somebody that has done it good for our country in the 21st century.
And of course, the contrast was he was trying to plant democracy in these lands in the Middle East at the point of a gun, right? Or at the point of a barrel. Yeah.
Democracy at the point of a gun while democracy was corroding at home, giving friends of his family and political persuasion all these, you know, the Halliburton deals to rebuild Baghdad while, you know, cities like, you know, Gary, Indiana, or Cicero, Illinois, or Youngstown, Ohio were in utter disarray. He seemed removed and aloof from the realities of American people, and instead wanted to do this cowboy diplomacy. And I say this with great sadness because George Bush 43, did have a remarkable week, I think, after 9/11.
Yep.
When he led the country about through to heel, when he wrapped his arm around the firemen at the rubbish heapage down at 9/11, you know, when he threw the ball out at Yankee Stadium, and he kind of unified the country, and he went on to build our homeland security apparatus after that, but then got overzealous and started trying to do Afghanistan and Iraq, and in the end, neither of them are better off today than before American intervention.
So with all of that perspective, Doug, that you've provided for the last three episodes here of the Bill Press Pod, we get to what's facing us today, a choice between two men who have held the office, each of them, for 4 years. After a quick break, let's just take a look side by side and see what lessons we've learned, what conclusions we can reach. We'll be right back with presidential historian Doug Brinkley. And today's podcast is brought to you by the Iron Workers Union of North America under the leadership of President Eric Dean. The iron workers say the sky's the limit, and boy, do they mean it. You look at most of America's iconic structures, the Golden Gate Bridge, the Sears Tower, the Arch in St. Louis, the New World Trade Center, all built by iron workers. Check out their website, ironworkers.org, to find out more about their great work. We salute the iron workers of America and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
And we're back on the Bill Press Pod here. What a great pleasure, what a great honor to spend the last 3 weeks with Doug Brinkley, presidential historian, if not the leading presidential historian, certainly one of our leading presidential historians. I think he's number one. Looking at the presidency and helping us make this choice, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, each of them have been there for 4 years. Donald Trump wants to come back for another four. Joe Biden wants to stay there for another four. So, Doug, welcome back. Let's just take a look at them side by side on some of the issues we've talked about, right? Let's start with experience. How do you line them up?
Joe Biden has a long experience as a statesman and as a politician who knows how to get things done. His career on Capitol Hill is famous. He was one of our great senators. He's a two-term vice president. I think his record as president in one term would normally demand reelection. What was done with in this climate in particular to get the Infrastructure Reform Act done to provide monies for bridges and roads, infrastructure, and taking climate science so seriously and trying to get a green, clean energy future. I think it's all been impressive. It's an administration without a lot of scandal. I think they've been attempts to make Hunter Biden the face of Joe Biden, and it seems to have failed. And he's respected around the world. With that said, Biden comes with these shortcomings. I've never been impressed by Biden as an orator. He works at it and gets better. His most recent State of the Union address, where he spoke high in decibels and you know, so and was loud, so he didn't seem meek, to shake the old age rap. I thought it worked, but there's always a feeling when you see Biden take stage that a gaffe could be coming, a misstatement, and it creates an oh no feeling in you, and that's not good. You should be able to see him and feel, wow, I can't wait to hear him knock it over the fence. So as a media candidate, he has some issues, but he's sane, and he represents a continuity in our democratic traditions. He's a defender of our institutions, of the Constitution, and, you know, is somebody who doesn't feel that with our economy doing as well as it is and our leadership still strong in places, particularly our NATO, with our NATO allies, he doesn't think this is the time for some radical new realignment on the planet, new global power. So I think there's a consistency with Joe Biden. You know what you're getting. And what you're getting is pretty good.
Yeah. I want to just, there's one phrase I always think of with Joe Biden, which I don't think you could say about the other guy, which is he's a good man, right?
I agree with that. And I think he
says a lot to
it
me.
It does say a lot. And I think you're dealing with a good American. He's a good person, and he means well, and he has a great track record, and he knows how to talk across the aisle. He doesn't demonize opponents. In fact, when he was a senator, he was known for, you know, spending time with people he disagreed with completely, like Orrin Hatch or Strom Thurmond, just to get a piece of legislation done. So that's the kind of person we want in politics. I understand it'd be nice if Biden was, you know, 10 years younger, but he isn't. And people just have to get over that. He might fumble a little more, as anybody in their 80s would. But his mind and his ability to make big decisions are still as sharp as ever.
And without belaboring the Trump side of the equation, I think what you're saying between the lines is that Trump is the opposite of everything you said about Joe Biden.
Trump is a one-man revolution. And I say that in all earnestness. If Donald Trump wins, it's a different America. It's breaking away from our tradition of the 20th and 21st century. It's a much more isolationist, go-it-alone strategy by Trump. He is going to want to dry up foreign aid that the United States provides for humanitarian crisis or for countries in trouble and peril. He's going to want to vilify Europe as being too needy on the United States. You can see terse relations, say, between Germany and the United States. NATO will start withering away. European Union will be in trouble. Trump wants to, I think some allies like Great Britain and Israel will be fine with Trump, but he'd like to see the world divided up, carved up into, you know, U.S., Russian, Chinese spheres of influence. And he's happy with that kind of big three and maybe big four, and if Europe can be looked at as a whole influence in the world. And with Trump, you're either on a Team America or you're not going to get a penny from us. And you could see some countries lining up with us and others not. But I'm worried about NATO, which I always find as being the cohesive to American foreign policy. I feel it's going to be in grave trouble if Trump gets elected, because he's already saying he wouldn't mind it going away or watching Russia invade Lithuania or Poland. And it just depends just how adventuresome and expansionist Putin is at this moment. Is getting the Ukraine enough, or has he got another misadventure up his sleeve?
And coming back home, looking again, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, what vision for the future, particularly for our democratic institutions, do you see difference between the two?
Well, I think what Trump will try to do is, day one, he will try to shut the border with Mexico, and you very likely will have the sight of roundups of millions of immigrants found in the United States by police, turned in and deported. He has evoked Eisenhower's policy of doing that a number of times. He'll get sued, and we'll see where it goes once he tries to do that. But in a larger sense, he is going to force NATO to pay more money. He will probably make a deal with Russia right out of the gate, call it he brokers a peace between Ukraine and Russia, but he'll make it clear to Zelensky, no more U.S. money. If you're going to fight on, you're fighting on without us, and I think you better take a peace agreement, which would give part of the Ukraine to Russia, and then probably create kind of a demilitarized zone in the rest of the Ukraine. Really, it's a loss for democracy, because the Ukraine will be under Soviet rule by and large. And same, we'll have to see what happens with China and Taiwan. Is about an intensive situation as one can imagine there. We have an activist North Korea with nuclear weapons. But, you know, the one thing Trump has going for him is he was president already. And there's some people that liked what they saw during that one term. And they're going to go back to him now, not realizing that it's a Trump that's even more angry, who feels victimized by the 91 indictments, who wants revenge on his opponents, and has made a decision that democracy is overrated, that authoritarianism is the wave of the future, and he's pioneering in that and likes to be bedfellows with other authoritarians. So it'll be a very strange presidency with Trump. I particularly feel the people that are going to pay the most are going to be those in the environmental conservation sphere, because he will open up all of our public lands where he can, which means BLM lands, national forest, and timber mine, strip mine, you know, take everything you can, gouge the public lands for one generation, so it becomes a sugar high on a Trump economy that might play well with some working people in America, but it's not what we do. We're supposed to be building America the beautiful to hand down to our children and our children's children. And that takes a sense of prudence and balance, not just yeehaw, let's grab everything for in one year when it comes to natural resource management. He is the absolute antithesis, Donald Trump, of somebody like Theodore Roosevelt.
I just had a chance last evening, actually, to read the profile of President Biden in the latest New Yorker magazine by Evan Osnos. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet, but Biden says he thinks that this election is all about saving our democracy, that's what's on the line, that's why he's running, that's what's at stake. Is that what's at stake, our democracy? I mean, is the threat of authoritarianism for real, do you believe?
I believe that if Trump gets reelected, we're taking a giant step towards a new kind of government, with one that has an authoritarian bent. And it does get overhyped by the Biden people, like beyond me. If you don't vote for me, Joe Biden, I'm the indispensable man. I'm the Lincoln of the moment. If you don't vote for me, America's going down, into a holy hell. I think that's overdrawn. What I think Biden's right about is he Biden himself is the personification of our democratic principles, of our Constitution, of our more ways in government, our traditions. And Donald Trump is a bull carrying his own China shop around with him, and that he's an agent of chaos, and he wants to shake things up, and he wants to downsize, just the way corporations will downsize. He wants to go into the Department of Transportation and get rid of half the people. He wants to go into education and either abolish it or get rid of half. And so you're going to feel the pain in a lot of different ways when he comes in, Trump, in bushwhacking mode. But will our country survive Trump? Yes, we're a country built to last. This is not some flimsy strip mall of a country. We're the most powerful country the world's ever seen. Our corporate sector will continue to produce. There's no sign that we're going to have a meltdown on Wall Street. And as I said, some people will benefit by the stripping of the lands and an all-gasoline approach to energy. It'll be a major setback for people in the climate movement, people that are real all about wind and solar or electric cars. These are not areas that Trump's comfortable in or believes in. And so they're going to be scientists will be very disappointed with Donald Trump because he won't believe their science. He'll believe his own BS. and you know, so it does. I could see why some people say they want to leave America if Trump gets reelected. But in truth, this is our country where we're born and we fight for. We fight for it because we know all of its greatness in different ways. And you know, there's always the next fight. I mean, no sooner does Trump get in, but within months, there will be people challenging what he does in courts. He's going to meet his own comeuppance in various ways if he won. And there'll be an election in 2028, and you already see the Democratic Party shining stars like Gavin Newsom or Andy Beshear or Governor Whitmer. Those are just Cory Booker. I mean, and there'll be a new group, and Trump won't be running again, and it could be new leadership the next round. So I wouldn't lose faith in America no matter what. You got to believe in this country. It was built to last. Born here, we're going to die here, and we have to fight for it. But there's no question the difference between Biden and Trump is huge. And Trump, in my mind, is a danger to our democracy and the kind of figure that you don't want to play footsie with because he has no sense of the social order that our country's developed over time, and he has no sensitivity to people of color or people of a certain ethnicity. You know, he'll say crude and ugly things just to hurt or tear people down. And it doesn't meet Bill that, does character matter? He has no character. I mean, why are we electing, con men and shysters and wheeler dealers, casino magnates? Is that the right person temperamentally to be running the United States of America and be in charge of all of our armed forces? Is he supposed to be a figure we look up to? I think in all those ways, it's a big no. So Biden has a lot going for him, but this divided third party scenario here and the fact that we're on the Electoral College, not popular vote, it's an uphill lift for Joe Biden to get reelected.
Yeah. So on that chilling message and also that positive, upbeat message, let's leave it right there for November 2024. Of course, there's a lot can happen between and will happen between now and then as well. Doug Brinkley, I cannot thank you enough for spending so much time with us and sharing so much that you've learned from your lifetime of studying the American presidency and writing about it and helping us all understand it better. I greatly admire your work, longtime fan, and again, so grateful, Doug, that you would join us here on the Bill Press Pod. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate all you do.
And there we go, the American presidency. We've looked at it now from four different perspectives with Professor Doug Brinkley. And we're ready to go. We've got a lot more information, I hope, that to not only reinforce our thinking about this election and how important it is, but to help us convince our friends how important it is, and to convince all of us to get to work. A big thank you to Professor Doug Brinkley for spending so much time with us. Thanks to all of you for hanging in there. I'm sure it was as important, and I hope it was as important and as helpful to you as it has been for me, even though I've already made up my mind how I'm going to vote in November. And now, with all this new information, all the lessons we've learned, let's reach out to our friends again, and all of us just get to work and not stop working until close the White House door to Donald Trump once and for all. In the meantime, yes, the drudgery in Washington continues to go on. Yes, indeed. Whether they get anything done or not, we'll take a look in our Reporters Roundtable this coming Friday on what's happening in our nation's capital, in the Congress, at the White House, around the agencies, and across the country on the political scene with three of our best top political reporters. We'll see you Friday for the next edition, our Reporters Roundtable, the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.